This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers' Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm sitting here, sort of, virtually, with my colleague Evan Osnos, who's been covering politics for us since 2008, hard to believe. Now, Evan, you've been working on a profile of Joe Biden for quite some time, and at the end of July, you went to meet him at his home in Delaware. What were the circumstances? What was it like to talk to him in person at that moment?
Well, as you can imagine, he was sort of glad to see another human being because they have him under very tight restrictions. There's basically two aides that go in and out of the house, one of his assistants and one of Jill Biden's assistants. And then there's this Secret Service detail. But other than that, they really don't have a lot of people coming in and out. And so they said, first of all, you got to wear a mask. And they said, we're not going to be in the main house because we don't want you potentially contaminating where he lives. So they put us in a kind of carriage house at the foot of the property. And we sat across from each other in a room. It was too hot to sit outside. It was somewhere in the mid-90s. And they said, so we're going to sit across from each other and don't touch.
So how did you handle the social distancing? Give me the, you know, the scene where you're sitting, how far apart, could you hear him?
So I was sitting in a chair waiting for him to arrive, and first thing I hear is his voice, actually, before I saw him.
Welcome to my mom's house. How are you?
She's done pretty well.
He said, welcome to my mom's house. And that's because the little house that we were in had been built for his mom shortly after his dad died.
Well, I'd walk in and she'd be in that chair downstairs facing the fireplace watching the television. She had a hassock there.
And he then, without me asking a question, this was kind of, you know, the Biden at his most Biden-like, where he just launched into a story.
This used to be a little tiny barn.
Telling me about the history of the house and why he built it and what it meant to him and his parents and so on.
She said, Joey, if you build me a house, I'll move in here. I said, honey, I don't have money.
And in some ways, you know, I was struck by the fact, David, that we've all been listening in one form or another to Joe Biden since the Nixon administration. I mean, this he's been a feature of public life for so long. And there is a very recognizable Joe Biden way of thinking out loud, where he kind of wanders around occasionally. And then right at the moment where you think we have really lost our way, he lands on something. And he lands on something meaningful. And there was an example of that that really struck me.
What was that?
I asked him, what did you learn from the protests after the killing of George Floyd? What did you learn, actually? And he said, at first he started talking about his history of sort of thinking about civil rights and the black freedom struggle. And we were veering off into history for a moment. And then he said, you know, I got to be honest, I was embarrassed to discover that one of the myths that I had believed in for a long time was not true. And that myth was that we were marching forward slowly but inexorably in the direction of greater recognition of the existence of discrimination and systemic racism in our society. But we were moving in the right direction. And he said, what I was wrong about was that I thought we could actually eliminate hate.
What I didn't realize, Evan, and this is what I'm embarrassed to say, I thought you could defeat hate. You can't. It only hides. It crawls under the rocks. And when given oxygen by any person in authority, it comes roaring back out. And what I realized is the words of a president, even a lousy president, matter. They can take you to war, they can bring peace, they can make the market rise, they can call it fall, but they can also give hate oxygen. Were Trump not running, I probably wouldn't be running. But it was, he's so contrary to everything that I believe about government. And that's sort of the antithesis of what I think we should be doing. We have always talked about, we've thought about, we've never lived up to, we the people hold these truths to be self-evident. Every kid learns them. I think most of us thought, even those with a lot of experience, thought that it's always going to be that way. We've never met it, but we constantly move closer and closer and closer to more inclusion. And all of a sudden, you're thinking to yourself, holy God, look at these guys. Look what's happening. Look what's being done. Look what's being said, not just by him, but by his followers and some of his elected colleagues.
Evan, we saw very clearly at the Democratic convention that Biden is running on the idea that his presidency would be a kind of restoration, that it would restore the country to an extent spiritually as well as politically, that he'd bring a sense of non-emergency back to American public life. What are the risks of running such a campaign?
That can sound at times like something really unappealing, which is a return to status quo ante, which was all of the conditions that led to Donald Trump, like radical inequality, completely untended issues around race, around the basic structure of American capitalism. And that's what worries people, is they say that in his zeal to say, well, I'm going to bring us back to normalcy, that becomes actually an excuse for not taking on the hard problems.
Well, a return to normalcy would include and it already includes environmental disasters that make this pandemic look like wiffle ball.
And that's actually an issue that he is showing himself to be more movable on. I mean, one of the things, if you look at what's happened to Joe Biden over the course of the last few months since he secured the nomination, is that he has done the opposite thing that usually Democratic candidates do. Usually they get to the general election and they start marching to the right because they have to win over all these general election voters. Actually, he's gone the other way, which is a reflection of how much he realizes that they need to bring in the left. They have become more progressive on issues, and one of them is on the environment. I talked to a number of people who have been at the sort of leading edge of progressive climate politics. And they said, look, we did not expect that Joe Biden was going to move to the left. He's ended up coming to a position that's much more aggressive, much more ambitious than they thought he would. And I think that's because he didn't come into this race with a fully baked climate policy. It's one in which he sees that as something where he can move. And they've pushed him.
I think what people found out, and maybe you already knew, I don't know, is my record on the environment was way ahead of everybody else's. I mean, for real, that sounds like, you know, but for God's sake, that's how I got engaged in the first place. So what happened was they'd say, oh,
yeah,
well, you're the guy back in 86 who said global warming is a big problem. Or you're the guy that did the Coastal Zone Act and made sure it was like, oh, my God, didn't realize that. How does that happen?
They put together these task forces that combined some Bernie Sanders people with some Joe Biden people on issues like climate change, the economy, and so on. And a lot of the Bernie Sanders folks were pretty dubious at the outset, and they said, is this going to be real? And I talked to them afterwards, and they said, we actually were surprised at how much they were willing to talk to us and how much it came through in the platform.
And when people look at these task forces and they see the work, that was a really ecumenical group. You brought in a lot of people.
It really was. It was a difficult decision.
Risky.
No, for real. I think you fully appreciate it because I had to be sure that Bernie was serious, wasn't going to make this an ideological jihad here.
Yeah.
I said, Bernie, if you want these set up, in order for me to try to insist that I be for Medicare for all, if I insist on and go down the list. I said, this is not where it's going to go. But I said, I'm open. I hear you. I'm ready to listen. And I'm involved. And so let me know. Two things happened. One, I was convinced that I had to move further on some things that I hadn't focused on. For example, it's going to be very hard, but it makes some sense to move the Social Security age to 60. That's going to be hard to do, but it makes sense to do it. Secondly, I realized that, you know, I am paying off Bo Biden's college loans. He never missed a payment. Yeah. But when he graduated from undergraduate school and law school, it was $124,000 he owed. My generic point is, when you look at it, all of a sudden, it becomes clear and clear that this generation has really been screwed. These were really the most open, the most least prejudiced, the brightest, the best educated generation in American history. They're beginning to graduate, the relatively young millennials to the Z's. What's happening? They end up with 9/11, they end up with a war, they end up with the Great Recession, and then they end up with this. And so this generation,
yeah,
deserves help in the middle, yes, of this crisis.
Evan, it sounds as if Joe Biden, at the tender age of 77, is making an argument for generational change. Now, how is that supposed to work?
Well, part of this is his own self-image. Remember, he came into office when he was the pushy young guy. You know, he was so young when, right, he was elected to the Senate that he wasn't even old enough to take his seat on the day he was elected. He had to wait until after the, you know, until he was actually sworn in when he was old enough.
Evan, all in all, do you feel like the tensions between Biden and the left have been largely resolved? Because those tensions were really pronounced. And were there still hints of those tensions at the nominating convention?
Yeah, there were moments where it felt as if the tensions within the party had been suppressed for the moment. I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was given a specific task, which was to formally nominate Bernie Sanders. And it was a brief speaking slot, and some people would have liked to hear more from her. But the larger effect was that they decided that for the moment, they really did try to have a fragile peace of a certain kind, and there will be time for those fights to resume if they're lucky enough to win the presidency.
With Biden is the past prologue. In other words, he has on his record certain things that would speak of his right-mindedness or virtues, but he's also got, he voted for the deregulation of Wall Street, the Defense of Marriage Act, NAFTA, the war in Iraq, and more that certainly don't count on the progressive side of the ledger. Does that history give us any hint as to what his priorities as president might be?
Well, I think they tell you a lot about how he conducted himself in the Senate. And those are the elements that really do haunt him now as a presidential candidate. And, you know, that is the record of a traditionalist, of somebody who was, you know, more or less willing to go along with the Washington establishment. If people thought that it seemed like a war in Iraq was an inevitable or necessary fact, that's ended up where he lined up. But I think there's something that is important to think about in assessing that record, and that's the degree to which he is willing or not willing to reflect on the mistakes that he made. And on some of these things, you hear that from him, and on some of them, you don't. So for instance, when we talk about the crime bill of 1994, which is perhaps the most glaring example of ways in which he has a legislative record that has made damaging results in American society, what he will say about that is, I was wrong to support the distinction between crack cocaine and powder cocaine, that which ended up visiting terrible harm on communities of color, that was a mistake and that I was wrong about that. And what he doesn't say is, I was wrong to vote for the crime bill, he says, because Bernie Sanders and the, you know, the Congressional Black Caucus was with me on that. And so in a way, he's saying, judge me partly, yes, by how I look now, but also judge me in the moment in which it happened.
I mean, the good news is the bad news. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows me. And you guys know me, the good and bad. I'm not making it out. I'm just this wonderful person. But kind of hard to pin a label on someone that's inconsistent with who they are. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So to make me out to be a revolutionary, it's awful hard to do. Conversely, it's awful hard to make me out to be a right-wing, you know, a very conservative Democrat, because I've never been either of those. So there's a benefit about, you know, have I lost my temper and say things I shouldn't, that old joke, you know, about no one ever doubts I mean what I say. Sometimes just say all that I mean.
I'm David Remnick, and I'm here with staff writer Evan Osnos. We'll hear more from his conversation with Joe Biden in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Staff writer Evan Osnos just published a profile of Joe Biden in The New Yorker, and it's called Can Biden's Center Hold? The piece explores the tension between Biden and other centrist Democrats and the party's emboldened left wing. Evan sat down with Joe Biden in person, and we're hearing portions of their interview today. Now, Evan, has the COVID crisis reshaped the electoral map in any way for Biden?
Well, it's transformed the electoral process. I mean, there is none of the state-to-state marathon. He is not doing a dozen speeches a day, which is what a candidate usually does. And for a candidate like Joe Biden, to be blunt about it, that's actually been a great benefit because he has a history of making mistakes when he talks, of saying things that get him into trouble. And he's under a much more controlled environment. I mean, he's sleeping in his own bed every night. He's exercising in his house. He's giving very controlled speeches to audiences that are essentially handpicked. So from that perspective, it has been a completely unpredictable benefit to his candidacy.
I feel good about where we are nationally. And I feel good where we are in key states. But I know that it's going to get really, really ugly. He is going to continue to lie. And what I do worry about, to tell you, Evan, for real, is I worry about them screwing around with the electoral outcome. And, you know, he's, you know, when the hell have you ever heard a president say, I'm not sure I'll accept the outcome. You know, I'm not committing to that.
Yeah.
And he has really violated basic basically every democratic norm. And the consequence of that is that the American people are beginning to see it. And I pray to God, for the sake of the country, not me, that they don't buy his appeal to racism and his appeal to this overall division and just splitting the country.
Now, we're talking in the latter days of August. You basically have September and October left to go. Where are the Biden people going to focus their energy from now until Election Day?
Well, there are more or less half a dozen states which they consider to be the essential swing states. Some of these we all know. It's Florida and Pennsylvania. They are actually looking, though, at places that we don't ordinarily think of as Democratic prospects, like Georgia and Texas. And they what they believe is that there, every candidate would like a landslide, but in this year, they are even more determined that that's going to be vital for them because that may be one of the factors that determines whether or not or how much Donald Trump contests the result.
Do the Biden people think they're going to wake up on November 4th knowing who won or lost?
They are. No, they're digging in for what could be a really messy result. I mean, as Joe Biden put it to me, this thing's going to get ugly. And one of the things that Democrats have learned since 2000 is that in the year 2000, when Al Gore and George Bush had this contested result where it wasn't clear on the morning after the election who the winner was, Democrats made a terrible mistake, they now say, which was they were not as fast to move. They were flat-footed. And this time you see that their Democrats have set up a variety of kind of legal SWAT teams who are prepared to go into states and begin to file all of the legal procedures necessary to try to contest this thing.
40% of the electorate seems on board for Trump being reelected. What does Biden make of those voters? Are they changeable? And what does it say about the country in his view?
I really was struck by the fact that Biden doesn't characterize them as deplorable, you know, to use the famous term that Hillary Clinton regrets she ever used. And I think that's partly tactical. He's trying to win them over in the election, and he's not going to make a moral indictment.
The way I feel about it is I'm kind of in a position that FDR was. I'm not comparing myself to FDR, okay, for real. So it's not like Biden says he's like FDR. But it does not require an ideological answer. If you think about it, what in fact FDR did was not ideological. It was completely practical. How do we keep America from going totally in the tank and staying in the tank? And what he did was he focused on the things that would create jobs and include more people and generate more security. Physical as well as personal security, from Social Security straight through to what he did relative to, you know, World War II. And so the idea is just, you know, you just don't take the downsides. You know, corporate America has now been bailed out twice. And it's, we got to say, hey, guys, we got to let's look at what works.
The plans that they've laid out, for instance, use things like rolling back Donald Trump's tax breaks for high earners, for real estate investors, to pay for things like care for the elderly, things that right now are progressive priorities that are part of coming up with a new compact. This is where the sort of practical meets the ideal. And the ideal is to come up with a government that is actually meeting the day-to-day needs of people.
When I ran the Recovery Act,
yep.
Evan,
yep.
That was over $80 billion. I mean, $800 billion.
Yep.
Less than 0.2% waste or fraud. I did it every damn day for 18 months. You think I'm joking? I mean, it was constant. I'd have a governor or mayor say, well, I'm going to use the money to do the following. I'm going to build a polar bear park. I said, no, you're not. He said, well, it says I can. I said, yeah, you can. If you go ahead and do an IM account and hold a press conference saying you're wasting money.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't want to put in iridescent light bulbs in my streetlights. I said, well, you're not going to get the money then. Mm-hmm. It didn't say I have to do that. I said, go ahead and do it. I'm going to call a press conference and say.
Right.
Biden came out of a old-fashioned Senate that had aspects of bipartisanship to it, at least on the surface, and at least in Biden's imagination of the past. As part of the Obama administration, he faced just pure obstructionism from Mitch McConnell and the Republican Senate. If he's facing a Republican Senate this time around, if he's president and if the Republicans prevail in the Senate, as well they might, how does he go about overcoming that any better than Barack Obama did?
Well, the biggest risk that he's facing, I think, is that he gets into office and he says, you know, I can sweet talk these guys. I can encourage them, as he sometimes says, to have an epiphany, to, you know, Donald Trump's gone, and let them actually begin to govern again.
Let's drill down on what you reasonably anticipate the Republican opposition to be like. So what do you reasonably anticipate they are going to do to try to impede your ability to get things done?
Well, first of all, I think it depends on, assuming I were to win, how well I do.
Yeah.
If we win and we pick up 5 or 6 Senate seats, I think there'll be an epiphany. I think there'll be a very different view, because all you need then is 3 or 4 or 5 Republicans who have seen the light a little bit, number one. Number two, I don't think you can underestimate the impact of Trump not being there. The vindictiveness, the pettiness, the willingness to, at his own expense, go after people with vendettas, like you saw with Sessions, that brings a lot of people up short, number one. Number two, I never expect a foreign leader I'm dealing with, or a colleague, senator, congressperson, to voluntarily appear in the second edition of Profiles in Courage. So you got to think of what is in their interest.
He also believes, and I think there may be a kernel of reality in here, that removing Donald Trump from the scene could unlock a few votes around the edges. Now, whether it changes the fundamental chemistry of Congress, that's a fantasy. I don't think there's a way in which the Republican Party of today suddenly decides tomorrow that it wants to help Democrats win. But whether they can begin to do some things that are possible... I'll be blunt about one piece of this, David, which is, you know, as somebody said to me who worked in the Obama administration, there may be things that Joe Biden's going to be, in a sense, allowed to do by Republicans because he's not black. That's a really ugly fact of American politics right now. Mm. But Obama's identity, the fact that he was a history-making president, also engendered this, what we now recognize is this very ugly racist element within Republican politics. Let's call it what it is. And whether Joe Biden is going to encounter that or not, we don't know.
Evan, a big part of his appeal is said to be his deep acquaintance with personal tragedy. Now, you know, I don't know many lives, certainly after a certain number of years on this earth, that don't get acquainted with personal tragedy. It seems like an inevitability of life. Why is that so deeply a part of his appeal as opposed to many other politicians?
It's tempting to write this off as political cliche, but you cannot spend time around him without running into people who have had these unusual moments with him where something bad happened in their lives, and he gives them his cell phone number and starts having phone conversations with them. I mean, these are people who are not public people. I talked to a guy up in Dearborn, Michigan, who runs a coffee roaster business. And Biden's campaign tries to get Biden on the phone with one regular person a day. And they happen to get him on the phone with this guy, Mohammed Kazaz. And when he called him, Mohammed Kazaz happened to be quarantined in his house on the third floor away from his kids with COVID. And they ended up having this phone conversation, which Mohammed Kazaz recorded and played for me. But, you know, at the end of it, I asked Kazaz, I said, yeah, what did you take from this? And he's like, frankly, I just needed somebody to let me vent. I just needed somebody to talk to. And it's an odd role to expect of our president to be anything like solace. But Joe Biden may not be the one who gives us these bold pronouncements or grand rhetorical moments, but he might be the person who can have some individual connection, some meaning with people who are hurting. And frankly, as a people, we are hurting.
The New Yorker's Evan Osnos. He spoke with Joe Biden at the end of July, and his profile of the candidate Ken Biden's center hold is at newyorker.com. Rachel Syme is a staff writer who covers fashion in its many forms for The New Yorker. She's written for us about the trend toward high-rise jeans, a history of the tracksuit, and now she's going to show off the must-have fashion item of 2020, and I do mean must-have, the face mask. Rachel, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
You getting out of the house much?
I wish I was more, but I'm taking a lot of walks. I took a bike ride to Central Park this weekend.
Did you wear a mask?
I did wear a mask.
Good, because that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about masks and mask fashion, because in a time like this, we could use a little diversion, I think.
I think so. Let's divert.
So, what is the mask of choice that I should be looking at, or we should all be looking at?
Well, listen, I'm no doctor, so I can't tell, but I think, you know, mask wardrobes are becoming a whole thing. You know, people have like a daytime mask and an evening mask. I mean, there's everything from the basic medical sort of paper masks all the way up to masks that cost hundreds of dollars, if not thousands of dollars. For example, Burberry recently announced that they will release a mask in their trademark plaid with the red and the brown stripes, you know, like if you're going out fox hunting, that kind of a vibe.
Ah, fox hunting.
Yeah, that's, I think, $130. Off-White, which is Virgil Abloh's label, made a mask that just says Off-White, like they always do. They branded everything.
So the era of conspicuous consumption persists even during the plague.
I mean...
too weird.
Unfortunately, too weird. Yes.
What is the selfie mask?
The selfie mask is a very creepy thing that you can get where you basically send in a selfie to a company, and there's several companies that are doing this now, and they will print a mask with like the bottom half of your face so that it really looks like you, but it also kind of looks like a clownish, uncanny valley version of you, like you're wearing a permanent clown smile of yourself.
Is that a good look?
I mean, I think it's actually nightmarish. I feel like it's something from like a David Lynch movie. I don't know that I would. I feel like they're terrifying, but people want to look like themselves more than ever. I think people feel that a mask that blocks half their face, I mean, no one can see you smile. No one can see what your, you know, your facial expression really is. So I think people are trying to figure out ways to be more transparent, which leads us to this transparent mask called the Leaf, which is this, the best way I can describe it is it's a clear version of when you're in an airplane and the oxygen mask drops down. It's kind of like a little bit of a, it kind of looks like that very close suction to the face type thing. It's plastic and transparent, and then kind of also though has like a not transparent part about the chin, so it looks a little bit like you're wearing like old school like orthodontic headgear.
That's a memory that everybody will want to come back to.
Yeah. But at the same time, part of me just encourages people while we're in this mask phase of 2020 to embrace all these new options.
All right. Well, what I want to know is, what is the most expensive mask in the world?
Well, apparently a $1.5 million diamond and gold mask is coming out. Only for the purpose of being the most expensive mask in the world, just so they can say they did it.
That's just such good news.
I mean, maybe it's an investment piece.
Rachel, thanks so much.
No problem.
I'm definitely putting down a deposit for the $1.5 million mask with its diamonds and gold and N99 filters.
Yeah, I can't wait to see you in it.
Rachel Syme is a staff writer, and you can read her work, always a delight, at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The Republican convention last week was very much the Donald Trump show, co-starring the shouted stylings of Kimberly Guilfoyle. Trump talked law and order and the Democrats' post office scam, that's how he put it, and how things were pretty much perfect before, quote, the plague came in from China. 4 years after accepting his first nomination, the president's relationship to the Republican Party still confuses many people, both inside and outside the party. Is Trump an aberration within the GOP? Is he different from the party's culture and policy assumptions? Or does his presidency represent a continuity from the Reagan era onward? To answer that very complicated question, our staff writer Andrew Morantz sat down with historian and journalist Rick Perlstein. Perlstein has just published a new book called Reaganland. It's the capstone of his four-volume history of the American right. Here's Andrew Morantz.
So Rick Perlstein is this journalist and historian who he's been writing these really kind of monumentally big and immersive histories of essentially the 20th century American conservative movement. So just to set it up, you know, for those who don't know, for the last 23 years, you've been working on this four-book cycle, some 3,000 pages, right? How many pages?
Sounds about right, give or take. You know, it's like Everett Dirksen, you know, the late Illinois senator used to say a billion here, a billion there, and soon you're starting to talk about real money. You know, yeah, I mean, let's say 3,000 pages, sure.
Yeah. I've always been interested in his books because, you know, there's a lot of presidential biographies out there. There's a lot of, you know, books about American politics out there, but his books are kind of unique in how much they're about the mood of the country, the popular culture, what it was like day by day, week by week, to live through something like Watergate or to live through something like the late 70s where, you know, New York City is having a blackout and nobody knows, you know, where to go and everything is kind of chaotic. And that kind of feeling and that mood, you can kind of get from Perlstein's books in a way you can't really get anywhere else. Where Rick Perlstein starts his four-book cycle is with the 1964 race. And this was in an era when the two parties were not ideologically sorted the way they are now. There were liberal Republicans, there were conservative Republicans, there were liberal Democrats, there were conservative Democrats. It was a coalition of regional interests, but it wasn't, you know, ideological blocks. And it was actually seen as self-defeating to be too ideological.
So the narrative was that the American right was this kind of wild west of open racists, anti-Semites, you know, conspiracy theorists, was, you know, had no kind of purchase in American politics. But the idea is that, you know, William F. Buckley comes along.
We will explore the question of the future of the GOP and of the conservative movement. I take pleasure in introducing a great man and a good friend.
He's this, you know, bright young Yaley, speaks fluent Latin, you know, and he starts a magazine, National Review, you know, the marquee conservative magazine that started in 1955, in which he's going to turn conservatism into basically an intellectually respectable movement.
The only successful mutiny against the political scriptwriters in recent times, it having been ordained that no forthright conservative could be elected to any important executive office.
And that not in the through that act, that's what allows someone like Barry Goldwater to come to the fore as a nominee for the Republican Party without that taint of open racism, anti-Semitism, and all the rest.
So Barry Goldwater was this very staunch conservative senator from Arizona, and he stood for this ideologically principled conservatism, which was often called extreme. And actually, Goldwater famously embraced that label.
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
And when he got the Republican nomination, it was this surprising, shocking thing, kind of not entirely unlike when Donald Trump won the Republican nomination. But then what was supposed to happen next with Trump did happen with Goldwater, right? He lost in a landslide. So this thing that we were predicting would happen in 2016, that did happen in 1964. So then all these sort of nice, clean-cut liberal historians got to say what they wanted to say all along, which was Goldwater was always too fringe for the American electorate. He was never electable in the first place. This just shows that if you're too extreme and you're too ideological, you're never going to get anywhere in American politics, right? And so that became the entrenched narrative.
I really accepted sort of a standard narrative of the history of conservatism propounded by conservatives themselves that central to their political success, basically how they entered prime time, was through the act of disciplining the fringes of their coalition.
So Perlstein's second book is called Nixonland, comes out in 2008, and that's about the rise of Nixon, how he triumphs in these two big elections. Then in Perlstein's third book called The Invisible Bridge, we start getting Nixon's downfall. And by the middle of that book, Nixon is disgraced. He's left the White House. It just seems like no one of his ilk is going to be able to rise again. Nixon was this kind of shocking, alienating, angry figure. And so how can that right wing of the Republican Party ever be successful again? So you're kind of, you know, spit out into this landscape of, okay, Nixon's gone. The country needs a unifier. And everyone at the time is kind of assuming that that unifier is going to come from somewhere from the center of the political spectrum. And what Reaganland shows is that Ronald Reagan was able to become that unifier, not from the center, but by actually picking up on the really ideological, extreme conservative commitments of Richard Nixon and just kind of putting a more optimistic, shiny gloss on them.
I believe the Republican Party has a platform that is a banner of bold, unmistakable colors with no pale pastel shades.
One of the things that made Reagan's election so paradigm-shifting was that he managed to attract an enormous amount of former Democratic voters into the Republican coalition. But by the same token, in this, you know, long campaign in 1980, he received some rather remarkable endorsements, and perhaps the most remarkable was Martin Luther King's right-hand man, best friend, Ralph Abernathy, in whose arms Martin Luther King had died, who gave a very warm and enthusiastic endorsement of Ronald Reagan. Now, in a lot of ways, that shows the extraordinary charm and political gifts of Ronald Reagan, but it also shows a absolutely bedrock part of the Reagan strategy, which was that they knew that if they appeared, if what we now call, you know, sort of white swing voters in the suburbs, you know, associated Ronald Reagan with bigotry and racism, that they wouldn't vote for him.
But then as Perlstein is putting the final touches on this magnum opus, he's writing the fourth installment of how modern conservatism came to be what it is. As he's doing that in 2015 and 2016, he's watching Trump spit on John McCain's legacy as a war hero.
I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you. Do you agree with that? He's a war hero.
And, you know, talk about how all the Republican trade policies of the last 20 years should be thrown out the window and, you know, saying the quiet part loud. And
they're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
You know, all this carefully calibrated dog whistle strategy that all these Perlstein books show how carefully plotted the dog whistle politics of racism has been in the Republican Party, and how hard they've tried to build a Southern coalition based on, you know, appealing to racist tendencies but not saying that stuff out loud. As he's sitting down to write this book, Trump is winning a Republican primary by saying that stuff out loud.
This is a country where we speak English, not Spanish.
Can you think of a time when you were writing Reaganland and then, you know, you finished a day's writing and sort of like flipped on the TV and saw Trump talking about deporting 12 million people or saw him talking about, you know, executing the Central Park Five or something and went, I might need to revise what I wrote today? Or, you know what I mean? Did you ever have those moments?
You know, it's still happening, right? Right now we're talking as, you know, the QAnon cult, you know, that Democrats are, you know, involved in a conspiracy to kill children, right, is entering the mainstream as never before. And, you know, I woke up this week, you know, this week in which I'm promoting the book and, you know, thought, well, you know, a huge part of the anti-gay agenda that drove the Christian right during the period I'm writing, that really kind of replaced segregationism as the kind of guiding rage among fundamentalist Christians, was the conspiracy theory that gays were recruiting children. And in the case of a very prominent minister named James Robeson, who's still around and still prominent, in the spring of 1979, he gave a broadcast in which he said that gays in widespread organized fashion were not only recruiting young boys, but murdering them. His affiliate, the place where he recorded his show, it took him off the air because this was kind of like a last straw. He, you know, attacked other religions so much. And in this particular case, the local gay group demanded equal time. And this was a galvanizing event. He became a martyr. It became one of the galvanizing events for the politicization of the Christian right going into the 1980 election. And him and his young publicist, the fellow named Mike Huckabee, staged a rally in which 10,000 Christians hooted and hollered and basically were advocating for him to have the right to go around saying that gays were out to murder children. And Mike Huckabee was actually interviewed in The New Yorker. And he was quoted saying that there was so much feral rage in that building that if James Robeson had told people to walk down to the TV station and take it apart brick by brick, they would have done it.
I'm sick and tired of hearing about all of the radicals and the perverts and the liberals and the leftists and the communists coming out of the closets. It's time for God's people to come out of the closets, out of the churches, and change America.
Right, so that kind of energy is certainly not new with Trump. It probably has not had that much explicit representation in a place like, say, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, for whom, certainly in the case of Ronald Reagan, disciplining what got said behind closed doors and in public was an enormous part of the political work of that administration.
Rick Perlstein is a guy who writes from a left vantage point. He writes for leftist publications. He writes these books that are about the modern conservative movement. But yet, he's not writing these books as polemics about why conservatism is bad. He's writing a version of conservatism that actually some conservatives recognize themselves in. Like, he's more interested in giving a really rich chronicle of almost the psychological needs of the American populace. Like, what was it in the American psyche or almost in the American soul that made them yearn for someone like Ronald Reagan? This seems to be one of the underlying narrative questions of this book. Why was someone like Jimmy Carter not enough? Why did America fall out of love with him?
It is a crisis of confidence. It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will.
And I think where other people might look to some specific political outcome, or they might look to the hostage crisis, or they might point to this or that speech, I think Pearlstein's move is much more often to set a mood and talk about why the mood of the country was out of step with the mood that was being conveyed by a particular campaign or by a particular White House. 1977 was the era of Star Wars and Rocky, and that was what people were clamoring for. They wanted these very clear-cut stories about good versus evil. They wanted the heroes to triumph in the end, and Star Wars was not a Jimmy Carter type of film. Star Wars was a Ronald Reagan type of film. You know, so that's really more the kind of analysis you get in these books. Obviously, you get a lot of politics and you get a lot of, you know, who did or didn't vote for this or that bill. But in the words of another conservative figure of this century, Andrew Breitbart, he had this phrase, politics is downstream of culture. And I think that's the sense you get from reading these books, that culture and politics are certainly all mixed up together, and there's this kind of intangible mood of any given moment that I think Pearlstein would probably say is only fully knowable in retrospect, that he's trying to unearth, that I think sometimes can explain as much or more than, you know, a political science analysis can.
There is this, you know, constant appeal for, you know, reactionary ways of seeing the world, that the world is a scary place, America is a scary place, and people want to revert to, you know, easy truths and binary black and white ways of seeing the world. And that's just a constant in American history.
Rick Pearlstein is the author of 4 volumes on the conservative movement. Reaganland was published this month, and he spoke with Andrew Marantz, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. And please don't miss us next week when I'll be talking with Bette Midler, the one and only, about her new show. Have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.